Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. The January 6th Select Committee today offering an extraordinary glimpse into the strength of the evidence it has already collected against the disgraced, twice impeached ex-president Donald Trump, specifically on his efforts to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to violate his oath of office and overturn a lawful election result, as well as efforts deep inside Trump world to persuade Trump to stop the violence, which he, for 187 deadly minutes, failed to do or outright refused to do. The breaking news today, the Select Committee now breaching the innermost ring of Trump's family circle. His daughter, Ivanka, is being asked by the committee for information on her direct contacts with her dad, the ex-president, at key moments on the day of the insurrection. Among those moments, according to a letter from committee chairman Benny Thompson to Ivanka released today, quote, as January 6th approached, President Trump attempted on multiple occasions to persuade Vice President Pence to participate in his plan. One of the president's discussions with the vice president occurred by phone on the morning of January 6th. You were present in the Oval Office and observed at least one side of that telephone conversation. The committee also appears to zero in on Ivanka Trump's efforts as the insurrection unfolded to get Trump to step in and stop the violence. The committee going so far as to publish the testimony of another key witness on the efforts to get Trump to act. That witness is Pence's then national security advisor, Keith Kellogg. Here's a dramatic exchange from his testimony. Quote, question from the committee. Did you think that she, Ivanka Trump, could help get him, President Trump, to a place where he would make a statement to try to stop this? Answer from Kellogg. Yes. Question. So you thought that Ivanka could get her father to do something about it? Answer from Kellogg. To take a course of action. Question. He didn't say yes to Mark Meadows or Kayleigh McEnany or Keith Kellogg, but he might say yes to his daughter? Answer, exactly right. Kellogg goes on to describe multiple efforts by Ivanka Trump to appeal to her father. Question to Kellogg. And so presumably the first time she, Ivanka Trump, went in, it wasn't sufficient. Or she wouldn't have had to go back at least one more time, I assume. Is that correct? Answer from Kellogg. Well, yes, ma'am. I think she went back in there because Ivanka can be pretty tenacious. The committee also describing in its letter efforts by Donald Trump Jr., Laura Ingraham, Brian Kilmeade, Sean Hannity, multiple members of Congress and the press, Governor Chris Christie, and many others to get Trump to appear in the media to ask rioters to stand down. Here's one newly released text exchange between a White House staff member and someone outside the White House. It goes like this, quote, incoming text, is someone getting to POTUS? He has to tell protesters to dissipate. Someone is going to get killed. Response from White House staff member, quote, I've been trying for the last 30 minutes, literally stormed in Outer Oval to get him to put out the first one. It's completely insane. But of course, the entreaties for hours fell on deaf ears. And as far as Trump's actions as commander-in-chief, the committee writes this, quote, the committee is aware that certain White House staff devoted time during the violent riot to rebutting questions regarding whether the president was attempting to hold up deployment of the National Guard. But the committee has identified no evidence that President Trump issued any order or took any other action to deploy the Guard that day. Nor does it appear that President Trump made any calls at all to the Department of Justice or any other law enforcement agency to request deployment of their personnel to the Capitol. The January 6th Select Committee ensnaring the former first daughter and revealing the strength of its evidence against ex-President Donald Trump is where we start today. We'll be joined in a couple minutes by committee member Zoe Lofgren. But first, let's bring in Neal Katyal, former acting U.S. Solicitor General, now a law professor at Georgetown University, and our friend Carol Lennox here, Washington Post national investigative reporter. Both are MSNBC contributors. I have read this now three times. I've gone through and looked at all of the footnotes, and the references to documents in possession by this committee are would have me gobsmacked today. Neil, your first reaction?
Yeah, I think you should be gobsmacked. I mean, there's a lot that they've got, and Congress is now saying they want to hear from Ivanka Trump. And given how litigious the Trumps are, I think it's only a matter of hours before we see a lawsuit about former executives' favorite child privilege. But I think that's, you know, that's likely to happen. I think the timing of this is not surprising. It comes on the heels of a remarkable loss for Donald Trump by the U.S. Supreme Court last night, which in my judgment is a key step in restoring the rule of law in this country. And what that decision last night, what's gotten lost in the last 20 hours is what that case, Nicole, was about. And by that, I mean the specific documents. Congress was trying to know what Trump was doing on January 6th. They wanted his diary. They wanted a handwritten note that he wrote. They wanted to know what he did that day. And he went into court, including all the way to the Supreme Court, and said, no, the American people don't have a right to know what I was doing on January 6th. And he lost that claim 8-1 in the Supreme Court. And so it's not surprising today now you're getting calls from Congress for these documents, for additional evidence from Ivanka Trump and others, because it all goes to that key question. What in the world was he doing for 187 minutes on January 6th, particularly when his own daughter was trying to stop him from inciting and encouraging what was going on?
Neil, you said that that had been lost. Let's make sure it is found. These are the documents that will be handed over to the January 6th Select Committee as a result of that Supreme Court decision. Draft texts of a presidential speech for 1-6, presidential diaries, activity logs, notes, remarks related to 1-6, talking points for Trump press secretary Kayleigh McEnany related to the 2020 election, a draft executive order on election integrity, a handwritten list of potential or scheduled briefings and calls concerning election issues, and a draft proclamation honoring deceased Capitol Police officers. Carol Lenig, on the twin bombshells, the Supreme Court decision and the invitation for Ivanka Trump, who's been painted by a witness who's already cooperated as someone with singular authority in the eyes of Donald Trump to try to turn him from the posture he was in to one where he might say something to the rioters?
I think they are twin bombshells to the everyday public. I think on the law, the Supreme Court ruling was the only way the Supreme Court could rule. There was no legal standing to deny the committee those records of what a president was doing on that day. In fact, there is an argument to be made that many White House staffers and others around Trump broke the law by not keeping these records and preserving them properly by their own personal texts and other Gmails they were using on this day when they should have been preserving these records for perpetuity. It is a bombshell, however, nonetheless, because there were a lot of people quite concerned who watched the Supreme Court, who feared that some of the more political and ideological members of the court might rule in Donald Trump's favor. Remember, Donald Trump sort of famously said to me and to many others that he found the court appointees that he had put on the court horribly weak and gutless and disloyal to him because they did not rule in his favor on questioning the integrity of the election when it was free, fair, and confirmed by all authorities. On the second bombshell about Ivanka, I've got to say it's quite a day when you think about the fact that Letitia James in New York is now accusing Ivanka Trump of defrauding the IRS. Now, she's not bringing a criminal case at this moment, but that's essentially what she said, that Ivanka, they have significant evidence of her breaking federal law. And on this, at the same moment, she's being asked to come clean about how hard she worked on January 6th to get her father to keep people from being killed, including Republican lawmakers and including Vice President Pence, whom rioters were threatening to hang that day as he fled his own hideaway office. One last thing I'd say, Nicole, is that this moment is so important on the part of the committee because they're corroborating a lot of great reporting that's been done. Mm-hmm. They're reporting a lot of information that colleagues like, you know, of mine and me and my partner, Phil Rucker, gathered. But what they're revealing in whole is a lot of people who still publicly proclaim the big lie are revealed in these records to have recognized January 6th as incredibly dangerous, to have recognized it as a riot, not a tourist visit, to have recognized it as something that was totally disastrous for Donald Trump's legacy.
Well, one of the people who seems to think that as it's unfolding, it's nothing short of an atrocity is Sean Hannity. And that's certainly not the public position he takes on his broadcast. But he sends this message to Kayleigh McEnany on January 7th in a text. No more stolen election talk. Yes, impeachment and 25th Amendment are real and many people will quit. Kayleigh McEnany, who I believe was moonlighting at the RNC by this point, furthering the lies about election fraud, responds, love that. Thank you. That is the playbook I will help reinforce. Again, the playbook, no more stolen election talk. I believe she went on to engage in lots of stolen election talk afterward. How is that evidence most effectively used for what the committee's doing, which is piecing together the narrative of doublespeak, of liars lying to the public, many of whom would become attendees on January 6th at the president's speech at the Ellipse and at the Capitol insurrection, while privately communicating about how horrible the president's conduct and lies really were, Neil?
I think it's very significant. I mean, there's both a, you know, just a fact-gathering component to what the Congressional Committee is doing, and then there's potentially a law enforcement component. What was the state of mind of these individuals? Because for a criminal prosecution, you have to have mens rea, some bad intent. And as this evidence unfolds and you start to see Trump being told, that's what the committee is trying to figure out. What was Trump told? Did Ivanka go and try and intervene? Did Hannity, did others go and say to him, stop this? And did he then just sit on his hands or in some way actively encourage it? Those are the kind of key questions. And to me, it's just remarkable, Nicole, that the president went into the Supreme Court and tried to block the American people from getting answers to that those questions. I mean, that chart you just showed of what the January 6th committee was trying to get and what Trump tried to block them from getting, to me, is astounding. I see zero possible argument for how the American people shouldn't have access to that information. And kind of the most important thing you want to know is, what the heck was the president doing on January 6th? And he said, I get to keep this secret. And, you know, this is the Supreme Court is very conservative, I agree, but this is one in which I always thought they would do the right thing. And they did, because the consequences for a different alternative holding would have been insane. It would have been Soviet.
Carol, I want to ask you about another, I thought it was a revelation in the letter. Chairman Thompson writes this: the committee has information suggesting that President Trump's White House counsel may have concluded that the actions President Trump directed Vice President Pence to take would violate the Constitution or would be otherwise illegal. Did you discuss those issues with any member of the White House counsel's office? To your knowledge, were any such legal conclusions shared with President Trump? And then there's a footnote there, and the citation is a document in possession by the 1-6 committee. And I guess my question is, if the committee has information suggesting that Trump's White House counsel concluded that what Trump was asking Pence to do was illegal, is that a document that we've seen before? Or that's, I think that you and Phil Rucker went the furthest in reporting on, and correct me if I have this wrong, that the White House counsel believed there was a chance Trump could be arrested that day. So we've certainly understood from your previous reporting in the book that there was knowledge that the president was on very unstable legal grounds. But have we ever heard before that there might have been a document that the committee had that the counsel concluded that what Trump was asking Pence to do was illegal?
Just a sly editorial comment, Nicole, laser sharp memory. Yes, indeed. This is a new document. I've never heard of it. And indeed, we did report, Phil and I, that the White House counsel at the time, Pat Cipollone, not any shy, sideline kind of person who didn't want to support Donald Trump, had concluded that this was inappropriate. The president's actions on that day could have triggered a charge of inciting violence, as could Rudy Giuliani, as could the president's son's comments and actions, and was concerned enough about this to threaten that he and his colleagues, his deputy counsels, might resign if the president pushed this issue of sort of pre-pardoning anybody with regard to January 6th. Very concerned about the idea that the White House or any other officials might be drawn into a claim of obstruction by helping Donald Trump avoid some consequences for some of his actions that day. Now, of course, we know President Trump wasn't charged, wasn't arrested, wasn't accused of inciting violence or inciting a riot, but that worry was there. You're totally right about the document. And this could be anything, right? It could be, especially I would focus in on the words may have concluded. It sounds to me not like a memo from Pat Cipollone, which says I've concluded. It sounds like it could be a text in which someone says the White House counsel has already warned you that this isn't appropriate. It isn't constitutional for Pence to take this action. It could be anything, but I think it could be anything from a letter, a document, to literally a telephone text that's a few words long.
And we know that a lot of the documents that the committee has cited are things that were turned over in that 9,000 document dump from Mark Meadows prior to being held in contempt of Congress. We're going to put these questions to committee member Zoe Lofgren. We're going to ask both of you to stick around, though, to pick this conversation up on the other side. We will ask the Congresswoman about these explosive revelations on the frantic efforts to get Donald Trump to call off the Capitol attack as it was underway. And we'll ask her if there's more urgency now to get the former vice president to talk. Plus, after Democrats failed to change the rules in the United States Senate to pass federal voting rights legislation, President Biden's second year in office begins with a very tough path forward against GOP voter suppression efforts, which are ongoing. We'll talk about what's next in that fight. And later in the program, the investigation into the ex-president's insistence that people find him 11,000 votes in the state of Georgia just took a significant step forward. We'll tell you what that is, all those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere today.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
But I think it's also important for the American people to understand how dangerous Donald Trump was. We know as he was sitting there in the dining room next to the Oval Office, members of his staff were pleading with him to go on television to tell people to stop. We know Leader McCarthy was pleading with him to do that. We know members of his family. We know his daughter. We have firsthand testimony that his daughter Ivanka went in at least twice to ask him to please stop this violence.
That was January 6th Select Committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney a couple weeks ago telling ABC News that the panel had evidence that Ivanka Trump, the ex-president's daughter, had begged her father to call off the attack on the Capitol while it was happening. That allegation is among the many explosive details laid out in the January 6th Select Committee's letter released today to Ivanka Trump, all of it showing us as a public for the first time how much the committee already knows about what happened inside the West Wing on January 6th and the run-up to it. And that's before the nation's highest court rejected the ex-president's bid to cover up his actions and documents before, during, and after the insurrection, giving the committee access to a massive trove of White House records. Joining us now is Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren of California, member of the January 6th Select Committee. Neil and Carol are still here as well. Congresswoman, I wanted, the letter is the most revealing you all have been with some of this evidence, and I want to get into it. But first, Ivanka Trump has responded to the invitation through a spokesperson who has a weird response. It says, as the committee knows, Ivanka didn't speak at the January 6th rally. I read the letter three times. I didn't see anything suggesting she had. And then her spokesperson says she stated at 3:15 that day that any security breach or disrespect to our law enforcement is unacceptable. The violence must stop immediately. So they put her quotes in, I guess, from the day. But did you get any response to your offer to schedule an interview with her in early February?
I don't believe she's responded to that. And that statement from her spokesperson makes me think they actually hadn't seen the letter yet, because it doesn't really respond to the request that we made of Ms. Trump. Obviously, we had the direct testimony of General Kellogg about what he heard the former president say to the former vice president. We would like to talk to Ms. Trump about that. But we have direct testimony that Ms. Trump went in multiple times, at least twice, maybe more, to her father. I believe she was alone with him to ask him to call off the violence. We'd like to talk to her about that. We've got some indication that the former president was told by his legal staff that what he was urging the vice president to do was unconstitutional and illegal. We'd like to know if Ms. Trump knows anything about that. So we hope that she does respond in a positive fashion as a patriot and as an American who wants to get to the truth.
I want to deal with everything you just shared. And let me start with something you just said. This is in the letter. The committee has information suggesting that President Trump's White House counsel may have concluded that the actions President Trump directed Vice President Pence to take would violate the Constitution or would be otherwise illegal. Did you discuss those issues with any member of the White House counsel's office? To your knowledge, this is to Ivanka Trump, were any such legal conclusions shared with President Trump? And the citation is a document in possession of the committee. Are you able to tell us if you have a document created by the counsel's office or reference to a document created by the counsel's office with a legal analysis that asking Pence to do more than his ceremonial function would be illegal or unconstitutional?
I can't address that at this point, Nicole. And I think I'm sure your other guests will note that when you're doing an investigation, you don't necessarily want to reveal every piece of information that you've already obtained. That's going to help us get to the direct truth. I think the letter speaks for itself. We have some questions. We think Ms. Trump can answer them, and we certainly hope she does.
Congresswoman Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker had reported when their book came out that White House counsel Pat Cipollone believed there was a chance Donald Trump could be arrested on January 6th. And Sean Hannity's texts, which have been released by the committee, allude to a walkout, a mass resignation by the counsel's office. Have you spoken to members of Donald Trump's White House counsel's office?
Have I personally? No. But we are seeking to get all of the information we can. Let me divert for just 1 minute.
Sure.
Because a very significant decision was reached yesterday by the Supreme Court that will allow the committee to receive a very large amount of information from the archives. We hope that the Trump White House complied with the law and actually delivered all the material they were required to deliver to the archives. And we think that some of the answers will be found within that material. So I think at this point, that's the best I can answer your question.
It gets to something Dan Goldman and others have made, points they've made, that your document case, the strength of the document case, paper case, may make conversations about the few folks who have avoided your subpoenas irrelevant. And I won't put you on the spot, but is let me put up first what you're going to be getting. So this is what the Supreme Court decision frees up. Your committee will be receiving draft texts of a presidential speech for January 6th, presidential diaries, activity logs, notes, remarks related to 1-6, talking points for Trump's press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, related to the 2020 election, a draft executive order on election integrity, handwritten list of potential or scheduled briefings and calls concerning election issues, and a draft proclamation honoring deceased Capitol Police officers. When do you expect to have...
Among other things.
Oh, go ahead.
Among other things. I mean, we've asked for more than that, but that's a pretty good list.
When do you... And I worked in a White House, and again, it's a known unknown that the Trump White House, whether they complied with Records Acts and whether all their speeches were staffed the way a normal White House staffs, everything is on paper in a normal White House. There's no indication they were normal. But when do you expect to have these items and everything else that was hung up on this decision?
Very soon. We have received a little bit of information last night, and we're expecting... a large amount of material in the coming days.
And you think that all of it will be, I mean, it all exists and has been identified by the National Archives. So the decision frees up an immediate
yes.
transfer. Let me ask you about some in the letter to Ivanka Trump. There's this passage about Chris Miller's testimony, and it says this: Acting Secretary of Defense Chris Miller, who was in the chain of command and reported directly to the president, has testified under oath that the president never contacted him at any time on January 6th and never at any time issued him any order to deploy the National Guard. Miller did speak with Vice President Pence on January 6th, but not with President Trump. The committee has identified no evidence that President Trump issued any order or took any other action to deploy the Guard that day. Nor does it appear that President Trump made any calls at all to the Department of Justice or any other law enforcement agency to request deployment of their personnel to the Capitol. What are you pursuing with this line of inquiry?
Well, we're trying to find out exactly what happened. I personally have found, you know, as I was watching the riot out my window on the 6th, I wondered, where was the National Guard? And I think there's more to know. We're getting, you know, I'm not at liberty to disclose testimony without a vote of the committee. And so we've not had that. But I'll say that the picture is still murky. One thing that... the quote that you just read would indicate is that the president failed in his duty to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. It was under assault during that riot. We'd like to know more about that.
I mean, look, one thing that I thought when I read that, I worked for George W. Bush, and when he had a colonoscopy and was under anesthesia, there was a legal process briefed to the press and other world leaders yeah. that while he was under anesthesia, the vice president, Dick Cheney, would be in charge. And it was the butt of some jokes from critics, and it was internally very known that it was a process. I mean, the vice president can't just step into the chain of command. Is it your sense that Donald Trump wasn't functioning as the country's commander-in-chief during the insurrection?
Well, we'd like to know more about it, but obviously Vice President Pence was in some danger. He was in the Capitol himself. The mob was chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." There was a variety of calls going into the Defense Department from people who were in danger. So I think it was not necessarily a transfer of power so much as, you know, nothing was happening from the White House, apparently. And there was a real threat to our Constitution, to our system of government, and to the life of our vice president.
Are you pursuing any evidence, though, that he functioned as the country's commander in chief? I know that what Chris Miller testified to was a conversation with Vice President Mike Pence,
right.
but it's not clear who called in ultimately the National Guard. And Miller has said he never talked to Trump that day.
Let me just say we're still exploring that, including depositions today. And there are some more threads to pull to find out the answer.
It is. I know that there's so much more that you have than you can talk about. And when things come out, we're really grateful to get to talk to you about it and to have you enhance our understanding of it. Thank you so much for making some time to talk to us today, Congresswoman.
Thank you. Anytime.
Thank you. So, Neil and Carol, I'm coming back to you with these same, I can't come up with a better word, and I should work at it, but just bombshells that the committee, you know, has this testimony that essentially, and I ran this down because those were my memories from the White House. You can't just slide into the chain of command, but clearly Donald Trump never called in the National Guard that day, Neil.
Yeah, so I think, Nicole, you're pointing to a possible third bombshell here with your eagle eyes, which is this White House counsel may have concluded that Trump's request to Pence would violate the Constitution and the laws. In a way, that's not surprising news because it frankly just means the Trump attorney can read English, because it would have been a clear violation of the law for Pence to do what Trump wanted. So in that sense, it's not surprising that a Trump attorney would conclude that this was illegal, because it was obviously illegal. But that's, of course, not always a foregone conclusion when you're talking about Trump attorneys, people like Rudy Giuliani, who, you know, don't have any respect for the law. But Carol's explanation, and Carol's also a close reader, and what she said is, well, the letter says today from Congress says that they concluded it may violate the Constitution. And here's where I do think there's a bombshell, because, yes, that's what the Congressional Committee concluded. But putting myself in the shoes of a White House counsel lawyer, any real lawyer would have been definitive about this. This isn't something which you say, we advise you not to do this or something like that. But this would be true with any client who you think is about to engage in criminal acts. You say in big letters, no. In particular, when you're talking about Donald Trump, who only like reads big block letter Sharpie pen language, it's inconceivable to me that if the White House counsel so concluded it was illegal, that this would have been caveated or couched. It would have been explicit in bold letters.
Yeah. And Carol, there is some history. In as much as Donald Trump's White House didn't function like any White House that had come before it, there was some history of the McGahn counsel's office having a chief of staff who took notes, of the McGahn counsel's office at one point sort of straining the law and telling Trump that firing Comey wasn't advisable. There was a history of the White House counsel's office under prior White House counsels, not under Cipollone, but writing things to file, such as firing Mueller, could be viewed as obstruction of justice. So for as bizarro as this White House was, there was some, at least, you know, faint muscle memory inside the White House counsel's office to writing memos to file about occasions in which Donald Trump was clearly breaking the law. The other thing that I keep thinking as a staffer, if you're a staff, and I keep thinking of who's already complied, and Mark Short, Pence's chief of staff, has trashed the 1-6 committee, but he's complied with the 1-6 committee subpoena, which was to provide documents and testimony. If you're a staffer for Pence, you're desperate for the White House counsel's office to give your boss some legal cover for doing something that's politically catastrophic for him, which is defying Donald Trump's request to overturn the will of the American people. So the likelihood that there's something in writing from the counsel's office seems at least plausible.
It does seem plausible. And let me just geek out one more time on this and say the exact language of this letter is that we have information that Pat Cipollone may have concluded that this was unconstitutional and illegal, right? So may have concluded. So they have information that such a record may exist. And Zoe Lofgren just sort of gave us a little hint there under your very polite interrogation. She gave us a good hint, which is, we're going to get some records, and we think a lot of them are probably going to be from the counsel's office.
It's in
the
paper.
Help us figure all this out.
Yeah,
exactly. So I think that Neil's right. If there was a conclusion, it was a firm one, but they're getting evidence sort of secondhand that Pat Cipollone and his team may have reached this conclusion. Another important question, geeking out, is Miss Ivanka Trump, do you have any information that this was shared with your dad? Because that tells me, again, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, if you're a prosecutor or a reporter, any investigator worth your salt, it tells me someone told them Ivanka is aware of this conclusion. Ivanka is aware of conversations with her father about this conclusion and this warning from warning from Cipollone's office. I would also say I really appreciated you flagging and asking Congresswoman Lofgren about the MIA quality of the president, that the evidence that they have, that seems almost like a bludgeon at this point. You know, yeah. He didn't contact the attorney general. There's no evidence, I should say, that they contacted the attorney general when Congress members were in fear for their lives. He didn't contact, as far as they know, they have no record of him contacting the Department of Defense, not his secretary, not his chairman of Joint Chiefs. And Chris Miller has corroborated that in his testimony. They have evidence that he didn't talk to the FBI. And meanwhile, Phil and I, in our book, we revealed that Pence did exactly as you described, Nicole, slid into the role of being commander in chief, was the person on the phone with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, was on the phone from his hideaway with the Secretary of Defense saying, we've got to clear the Capitol. We've got to get this country safe again. That's just A, not following process, but B, seems to have been the only course that Pence could have taken because the president was bickering with his staff about whether or not he should ask his followers to stop attacking members of Congress.
Yeah, a former very senior national security advisor said to me that if you're Mark Milley, it might have been enough. You know, a call from Mike Pence might have been enough. The chain of command might have, to your point, Carol, at that hour, been murky. The president wasn't seen after the ellipse on the rally when he called for the attack, called for the march on the Capitol and called for Mike Pence to do the right thing. And I'm reminded in the letter that the tweet attacking Mike Pence comes out in the 2 o'clock hour. The attack on the Capitol started in the 1 o'clock hour. The violence was underway and he incites more violence toward Mike Pence. So I don't know what Ivanka Trump does now for a life or a job, but it seems like that'd be something she'd want to clear up where she came down on all that conduct from the ex-president. Neil Katyal, Carol Lenig, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. I could have talked to you the whole hour. Thank you. Senators are trying to pick up the pieces, at least on the Democratic side, after voting rights legislation failed last night. We'll talk about the bipartisan effort underway to move forward and why some Democrats say it still will not go far enough. That's next.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening?, we're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening? Wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Today, President Joe Biden's second year in office begins with a very different path forward against GOP voter suppression efforts and navigating the realities of a 50-50 Senate. After Democrats fell short last night in their attempt to change the filibuster rule on this narrow issue to pass federal voting rights legislation, with Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema siding as expected with all 50 Republicans to block it. There is, however, bipartisan support now in the Senate on reforming the Electoral Count Act, which was leveraged by Trump allies in their attempt to overturn President Joe Biden's victory in 2020. Politico is reporting that those talks include even some of the most forceful Democratic advocates for reforming the filibuster who are already lowering their expectations. But here was Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock's warning last night on the consequential difference between electoral reform and the much broader voting rights protections.
I support reforming the Electoral Count Act. That said, reforming the Electoral Count Act will do virtually nothing to address the sweeping voter suppression and election subversion efforts taking place in Georgia and in states and localities nationwide. It doesn't matter if your votes are properly counted if you cannot cast your vote in the first place.
Joining our conversation, Sam Stein, White House editor for Politico and an MSNBC contributor, and former five-term Maryland Congresswoman Donna Edwards, who has just announced that she'll be seeking another run at that House seat. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But Sam, take me inside what senators are going to have to settle for in terms of protecting our elections.
Well, they might have to settle for nothing at all. Although these talks are centering around a very tiny sliver of election law, I would just throw a heap of salt on it. They're in the nascent stages. It's not clear that they would have the support of the vast majority of either party. The one good piece of news I would say is that Mitch McConnell, while he hasn't said he supports the idea, he hasn't said he opposes it either. And this is sort of what he did with the infrastructure talks either. It's kind of an implicit go ahead to the moderate Republicans who are negotiating this, like Susan Collins, to find 10 votes. But even if they were to find 10 Republican votes, as Senator Warnock notes here, you're essentially asking people who have been championing these voting rights bills for the past year to swallow almost nothing, to say, we won't deal with suppression in the 20 or so Republican states where these laws have had, we will deal with a slice of subversion. And I'm just not sure at this juncture that the voting rights community is willing to turn around off of the defeat last night and say, okay, we will take this sliver of reform. Now, it could be a very important sliver of reform, as we saw in the 2020 elections. It could be weaponized or potentially weaponized. But I think the feelings are still incredibly raw right now. I think the fear is very raw, too. And it's hard for me to see at this juncture, at least, a path forward politically through the Senate.
Well, I mean, Sam, the fact that Republicans want this is acknowledgement that they know that everything that has been said and done in the spirit of the big lie is as bad as Democrats and voting rights activists say it is. Otherwise, why take this on? I mean, why do this if you're not aware of the danger?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I think there's a sliver of the Republican Party who says what Trump tried to do in blocking the certification of the elections, basically sending new electorates to Washington, D.C., that he believed should have been chosen because they believed his big lie. What he tried to do there cannot, you know, there shouldn't be loopholes in the law to allow that to even become a possibility. We need to close those loopholes. We need to sort of strengthen the guardrails of democracy in that form. They don't think that pertains to things like mail-in balloting, absentee voting, even passing along water to people who are waiting in line. Now, the vast majority of Democrats, almost all of them, say, no, that's ridiculous. As Warnock said, you can't just say an election's fair because we dealt with this one sliver of election law when you are suppressing the vote elsewhere. But I think Republicans are willing and feel comfortable saying, no, these laws in the states are not about suppression, but we do need to guard against something that Trump did in 2020.
And Donna, I think the reality in the states is that the people, and my colleague Rachel Maddow has really been instrumental in putting this story on the map. It's now the topic of some extraordinary reporting in Arizona, in Michigan. The local reporting is, I think, ahead of where the national reporting is on this. The fake electors, at least in Michigan, they put their name down as real electors, even though Donald Trump lost Michigan by 154,000 votes, was not close, and sent it to the National Archives, a potential criminal act of election fraud and forgery. And so dealing with what is perhaps the most flagrant part of the lie is, I guess, low-hanging fruit, but better than nothing. Is that how you see it?
Well, I suppose. I mean, let's be clear that dealing with the Electoral Count Act, as Senator Warnock described, is not a substitute for dealing with voting rights and ensuring that everyone who wants to cast a vote can do it and can do it in an unfettered way. I have to say, Senator Warnock's statement on the Senate floor last night may have been one of the most consequential statements in a generation that we have seen on the Senate floor, articulating really clearly what the problem is in all of these state laws and that we need to fix it and the moral imperative to do that. And so, you know, I think some Republicans may want to deal with the Electoral Vote Count Act because they want to get out of the morass of having rejected doing voting rights. But it is not a substitute and certainly cannot substitute from the egregious things that are taking place in the states and that we saw take place in 2020. And we're only now really being able to uncover that. But there is more danger in the future as state and local elections boards and officials are being taken over by these radical people who really would have supported substituting their names, substituting their judgment for the voters of their state.
Sam Stein, thank you for being part of our conversation today. Donna sticks around. Trump's presence and pressure looms over Republicans on the Hill. The toxicity there shows no signs of easing. And it is against that backdrop that we're going to ask Donna Edwards why on earth she wants to jump back into it. We are back with someone who is so important to the conversations we have every day on this show, who is now a congressional candidate. What made you decide to run back into the burning building?
Well, Nicole, thank you so much. I mean, we have talked about so many of the issues that really challenge us both as a nation and around the country over these last several years. And I decided I couldn't sit on the sidelines anymore, both for my congressional district, where we have seen some of the impacts of this pandemic that have exposed the inequities in education and healthcare and our economy. And I want to go back in Congress and fight for my district and fight for our country. We've talked so much on this show, Nicole, over the last several years about the damage that's been done to our democracy. And I believe that it's time for my voice with the leadership that I have. I've served in the majority and the minority as a rank and file member and in the leadership of the Democratic caucus in Congress. And I'm looking forward to going back, joining my colleagues, you know, feet to the fire to make sure that we can preserve and protect our democracy and so that I can fight for our congressional district.
You come on this show and we ask you to talk about what we're seeing and help us understand it. But you did a lot of listening. Talk about your travels while you've been out of office.
I did. When I came out of office, I actually got on the road in an RV that I borrowed from a friend. And I thought I'd be on the road for 2 weeks. And instead, I was on the road for over 3 months, listening and talking to people who didn't agree with me, people who had never spoken to a Black woman before in any kind of depth. And I learned a lot, and it gave me the perspective to come back to Washington, both in my analysis and my writing for The Washington Post, really committed to trying to understand the country and to come up with solutions. And it is actually with that spirit and understanding the breadth, the depth, the diversity of the country that I go back into the Congress. But it actually makes me redoubled in my desire to make sure that we can make changes that make a difference in people's lives. You know, things like healthcare and how much they're paying for prescription drugs and the roads they're on and the jobs they have. I'm ready for this fight.
Well, there is no one who has sort of had compassion for the tragedies of COVID and frustration with the attacks on our democracy and real insights on your colleagues. No one that combines all that like you do. So I hope you're prepared for us to continue to call on you as you transition from analyst to candidate.
And don't forget, Donna Edwards, the number 4congress.com.
There you go, guys. Donna Edwards, thank you for spending some time with us today, and good luck. The next Hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
I don't want to see Donald Trump go to prison, or Don Jr., or Eric, or Ivanka, or Jared, or any of them, simply because I politically disagree with virtually everything that they stand for. I want them to go to prison for the crimes that they committed. And in this specific case, Attorney General Tish James has all the evidence. She is what's called documentary evidence. She has the goods.
Wow. Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. She has the goods. Not exactly the words you want to hear if your last name is Trump. because what the former fixer to the former president, Donald Trump, is talking about there is a significant update in the New York Attorney General's civil investigation into the ex-president's business dealings. In a statement released late Tuesday, Attorney General Letitia James says she has, quote, significant evidence that suggests Donald J. Trump and the Trump Org falsely and fraudulently valued multiple assets and misrepresented those values to financial institutions for economic benefit. She says she is seeking legal action to compel Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump to provide sworn testimony. James's statement was released alongside a massive court filing detailing specific examples of the ex-president and his company lying about the value of its assets, findings that are very much in line with the Donald Trump we've all come to not be surprised by now for decades. As the New York Times reports, quote, Mr. Trump's penchant for hyperbole has defined every stage of his career, from real estate mogul to reality television impresario to U.S. president. And when it comes to business, Trump has conceded making the occasional exaggeration, once remarking that everyone inflates the worth of their assets, but that he did not do so beyond reason. But the question of whether such misstatements were simply showmanship or a pattern of fraud is now at the heart of the New York Attorney General's civil inquiry into the former president and his family business. James's filing was in response to last month's attempt by the ex-president to shut down her investigation and quash the subpoenas served to him and his kids. The Trump Org responded yesterday by calling James's probe politically motivated and saying, quote, her allegations are baseless and will be vigorously defended. The AG's office said it has not yet reached a final decision regarding whether this evidence merits legal action. But even so, it is not the only state investigation examining the ex-president's actions that is picking up steam this week. From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis is requesting a special grand jury to aid in her investigation of former President Donald Trump and his efforts to overturn Georgia's 2020 election results. Willis, who is looking into whether Trump committed a crime when he pressured Georgia's Secretary of State to find him 11,780 votes, cited the need to subpoena witnesses in her request, an authority a special grand jury would have. Intensifying investigations of the ex-president's conduct is where we start this hour with some of our most favorite reporters and friends. New York Times investigative reporter Suzanne Craig is here. She has covered the finances and taxes of Donald Trump and the Trump family since 2015, winning awards along the way. Also joining us, Harry Lipman, former deputy assistant attorney general and former U.S. attorney. And Donnie Deutsch is here, host of the On Brand podcast. I want to start with you, Harry Lipman, and let's take the two investigations separately. First, tell me what, sort of give me a viewer's guide, a non-lawyer viewer's guide to what Attorney General Tish James is saying in these filings.
Sure, because it isn't all that lawyerly, Nicole. Really, all she's saying is we have a right to depose Trump and his children. And there's not a big showing you have to make for that. So there's a little PR component. She's saying, since the Republicans and the Trumps have said this is in bad faith, let me tell you a few things that we have. And what they have are some really, really brazen lies, and exaggeration would not, or hyperbole would be, you know, nowhere near what we're talking about. Apartments that he said are three times as big as they really are, non-existent mansions, all kinds of grotesque disparities between valuations for one purpose and for another that defraud either banks or insurance companies. So she's got a really strong 12 instances, letter and verse, of flat out brazen lies that she's saying, for that reason, I get a right to depose the higher ups because so far the higher ups haven't cooperated.
Donnie, some of what we know in terms of the evidence James has is from your friend Michael Cohen. Here he is on CNN yesterday.
So I have provided documentary evidence going back to the House Oversight Committee, to the Attorney General's office, as well as the District Attorney's office. So I know specifically the documents that they have. On top of that, I'm not the only one. There are about close to a dozen corroborating individuals, which is so important to me, considering Donald Trump labeled me as a convicted liar, simply so that he could denigrate me and he could ruin my credibility in the event that this case goes further and he ultimately has to sit for trial.
Donnie, do you know who the dozen corroborating individuals are? And does Michael Cohen?
Michael Cohen would know who they are. I wouldn't be surprised if one of them is not the COO. I can't, his name escapes me right now. We know that Weisselberg is not. He's standing trial coming up for tax fraud. I find the whole premise of this, of the defense, the Trump defense, that people are given to hyperbole. You can't, when you speak to the IRS, you can't speak to legal folks, say, oh, I was just exaggerating. You know, I mean, I just, this Trump Tower apartment that I said is worth $300 million, where it's really worth $25 to $30 million. And I got a loan based on that as an asset. And there are 5 and 10, 20 other examples like that. Like, oops, that's just hyperbole. That's if you're talking to Forbes and trying to get on the Forbes 400 list, not for bank statements, not for loan statements, not for insurance statements. So there is what we do know. And James knows this, and the New York District Attorney's Office knows this, is what Donald Trump has done and his children have done, anybody else would go to jail for. I could right. take 1,000 cases, and Harry would be able to talk to this better than me. So the question is, obviously, in the Attorney General's case, it's a civil case. She could take assets away from him. And we still haven't heard from Brett, what was Cy Vance's office, which is now Bragg's office.
So, Suzanne, let me read this apartment part from the filing, which Donnie and Harry both alluded to. This was released this week. With respect to Trump's triplex apartment in Trump Tower, OAG has discovered that the valuations of this asset as incorporated into the statements of financial condition since at least 2012 were based on the assertion that the triplex apartment was 30,000 square feet in size. The actual size of Trump's triplex apartment was only 10,996 square feet. Because these valuations were performed by multiplying the number of square feet times a price per square foot, the reduction in the apartment square footage in the valuation from 30,000 to 10,996 indicates that the valuations of Trump's triplex in the 2015 and 16 were overstated by a factor of 3. As Weisselberg conceded in his testimony, Weisselberg admitted that this amounted to an overstatement of, quote, give or take $200 million. As Donnie's saying, Suzanne, these are exaggerations, lies that would land most of the rest of us in jail. What is the status right now based on what is public facing in this investigation?
Well, that exaggeration in itself necessarily wouldn't land you in jail. It's sort of what you do with it after you make the exaggeration. You can have the biggest, the best building. It can be worth $400 million. Where you get into trouble is where you submit false information to financial institutions, banks, insurance companies, and then you get a loan off of it. And that's potentially where you can get into hot water. What's interesting about what happened this week when I looked at all the documents was, a very, very common defense in this sort of situation is, well, I relied on the advice of professionals. I have accountants, I have lawyers. And in what the Attorney General in New York is saying is that the Trump family, and that's Donald Trump and his children, were much more involved in these inflating these values than we've previously known, and that they've overstated how much they relied on experts. Both can be true, that the Trump family could have been very involved and they could have had experts. But where the Attorney General is going with this and making a case is saying that the Trump family was just much more involved than we thought and was sending documents over and putting stuff in front of bankers to a degree that, you know, that could get them in trouble. And that's where that the Attorney General's heading on that.
And Suzanne, potentially consistent with that, the president's son, Eric Trump, invoked his Fifth Amendment right when he was brought in to testify. Is there any sense of what the line of questions were when he did that?
I think that they were asked about all of these valuations. You know, Eric Trump in particular is very involved in Seven Springs, one of the properties that they're looking at in terms of the valuations that were placed on it. That was definitely among the questions. But there, you know, that was the range would have been all the properties that he touched, which is most of them. And taking the Fifth Amendment in a civil case can be used against you. I sense that's why, or one of the, I think the Attorney General wants to interview all the Trumps, but once they are in front of her and they take the Fifth, it could be used against them in a civil case. So that's, you know, something that's got to be on the Attorney General's mind and her investigators.
Suzanne, a lot of what we knew prior to these investigations starting to have any sort of public facing tidbits or tea leaves was based on your reporting, which was based on documents, but sort of a limited view, if you will, of what happened in terms of how Trump paid taxes and what he claimed and what he valued. And a lot of what the investigators now have as a result of the Supreme Court decision to turn over and to have access to some of the accountants and some of the banks. What are you waiting to see based on all that you knew going into this and all that they have in addition to what you were able to see and understand?
Well, I think what's powerful about, you know, when we did a lot of this work in 2018 in particular, to have his taxes is one thing. We had 20 years of corporate and personal tax information for stories that we did in 2020. But what is so powerful is when you have, and we had the advantage of this in 2018 in the story that we did on Fred Trump's wealth, Donald Trump's father, is just putting all these pieces together and seeing not just the taxes, but the bank statements. You know, I was looking through the filings from the attorney general the other night, and they've got so much information from the accounting firm. There's information from banks, there's depositions. When you put all this together, it's very powerful. And I think we're going to see both something coming out of the attorney general. And then there's a separate criminal case going on in Manhattan where they also just have reams of documents. And it's how they all come together and how they speak to each other once you have them all and you're able to see, okay, well, here's money coming in here. Here's a valuation here. You've got emails and it you can kind of see who was talking to who and what happened.
Yeah. And you know, Harry, what is sometimes unsatisfying is that from the outside, these investigations necessarily have to hunker down and go through all the documents Suzanne's talking about. But there was some reporting about the kinds of folks, forensic attorneys and accountants who came in. And I wonder if you can speak to what this investigation has in front of it that we have never seen before. What will be new?
Sure. Well, first of all, as to the 12 who have cooperated, they are largely the sort of accountants and lower down folks who say, you know, I didn't say it was 30,000 feet. That was the information I was given. But what is new? You're going to have a paper case necessarily in either the civil or criminal context. But what you have that is sort of a goldmine for prosecutors, kind of as Suzanne is saying, is the contrast. Here is what they said to the tax folks. Oh, here is what they said to the bankers to get the loans. Look at this, you know, three-time discrepancy. That's not really hard to show. So that will be one. And then you'll have testimony from the likes of Michael Cohen that will speak exactly to this degree of involvement. Nothing happened without Trump's say-so. And moreover, one of his points of say-so was, don't ever email me. Don't ever put stuff in writing. So that's going to give a sort of portrait of almost a criminal enterprise with really a routine pattern of cheating, either taxes or insurance companies, depending.
Donnie, you've characterized Donald Trump's sort of reputation pre-political career as someone known to be shady. How does someone take a reputation and then go around? I mean, Michael Cohen seems to be so focused on this corroboration that has taken place since his testimony before the House. I believe it was under questioning from Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where he described the process. And I think it was around a football transaction that he inflated his assets to try to buy a football team. And he lied. He deflated them to try to get insurance. I mean, that has been testified to by Cohen. But clearly the painstaking work of corroborating all that and finding the paper is what has taken so long. What is your sense of whether all those allegations have been borne out or whether Cohen still gets called in to answer extra questions and provide new leads for people who can corroborate those allegations?
It seems Cohen's been called in, I think, 11 times already. And last time I was on the show, we were on the subject. You asked about timing, and he was being told by the lead prosecutors that the words were something's imminent, you know, that something's coming. You just have to use, and Harry would know this better than I, common sense. They're not doing all this for a dance. You know, it's good on the roosters are going to come to, and they're going to, the chickens or the roosters or some hens. What is it? They come to the, what's that saying?
Something's
happening with roosts or chickens and roosters. The other interesting thing, just taking this politically for a second, you know, you just wonder you know, everybody's talking about how he just owns the Republican Party. And you just wonder, the January 6th stuff, this stuff, in a new NBC News poll, they said, they asked Republicans, is your allegiance to the party first or to Trump first? And 56% said to the party first and only 38% to Trump. That's a tremendous, tremendous switch. And you just wonder if this stuff, even just from a legal point of view, beyond the legal point of view, starts to chip away, and where people will start to say, you know, maybe DeSantis looks a little bit, we just don't need any more of this. But on the flip side, you've got the Maggie Haberman tweet saying, well, now we know more than ever, he's going to certainly run to protect himself. But this is chipping away. I really believe this does chip.
Well, and then I'll tell you more about the Republican.
I don't know.
Go ahead, Suzanne.
Well, and I think the other issue is that it could be, I don't want to say great for his reputation, but I think people will see him as possibly, you know, they're just going after him and he didn't do anything. And this is just a, you know, to use his phrase, a witch hunt. I don't think it necessarily will chip away. And I think prosecutors, when they're looking at this, they're weighing that issue about sort of charges and that's on their minds as they're going forward. I think and if you bring a case and it doesn't work, like in Manhattan, it's a criminal case. If they bring charges and it doesn't go their way, it just lifts him. So I think that cuts both ways when I think about it.
Harry, is that appropriate?
No,
that the potential politics are weighing on prosecutors who are making decisions about charging?
I mean, the short answer is no. There's politics and there's politics. So we think about Merrick Garland, who does serve at the pleasure of the president, might think, is he stepping on a hornet's nest? But I do think James has led with her chin a little bit starting in the campaign, where she basically gave reasonable people some basis for thinking she really was going after him. It should be without regard to that. She says in her statement it's without regard to that, but that's going to be the theme that they're going to, you know, beat again and again and again if she does bring charges.
Let me just say that if he were to commit a crime on tape, they'd do that anyway, which seems to be the case in Georgia, Harry Lipman, where he committed campaign fraud on a phone call with a bunch of people listening, asking Brad Raffensperger to find him 11,780 votes, exactly the margin of victory for President-elect Joe Biden. What is the significance of a special grand jury potentially being convened there?
Yeah, I always thought this was the most dangerous case for him. It's discreet. It's clean. It's got what prosecutors love, an audio tape, and goes through it. The special grand jury itself, Nicole, is not the biggest news. It's what you need to have a more than 2 month long investigation that you can subpoena folks and bring them in and out. I'm surprised she didn't do it earlier, but it does certainly show her resolve. And she's really dangerous for Trump because she's not subject to the same kind of political cross currents and disincentives. She's one DA and she has a strong, clean, simple case under Georgia law. The grand jury itself just is a necessary component to investigating it. If they actually bring the charges, it will be to a regular grand jury. They'll say, here's what the special guys found. Will you please vote this crime as an indictment?
Whole lot of jury duty for a whole lot of Americans just to keep Donald Trump accountable. Suzanne, Greg, Donnie Deutsch, thank you so much for starting us off on this news this hour. Harry will be back later in the hour. And when we come back, with fears growing by the hour over a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine, President Joe Biden clarifies the remarks he made yesterday during this hour while his administration announces new sanctions on four Ukrainians, including two Ukrainian lawmakers accused of working with Moscow to destabilize the country in preparation for a Russian takeover. All those new developments and a live report from Kiev are next. Plus, here at home, new calls to prosecute the fake electors in several key battleground states who signed their names to false documents in an attempt to claim that Joe Biden's victories for Donald Trump. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Hi, I've been absolutely clear with President Putin. He has no misunderstanding. If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion. But it will be met with severe and coordinated economic response that I've discussed in detail with our allies, as well as laid out very clearly for President Putin. But there is no doubt, let there be no doubt at all, that if Putin makes this choice, Russia will pay a heavy price. It's also not the only scenario we need to be prepared for.
That was President Biden this morning on the topic of Russian aggression, adding further context to remarks he made during his news conference yesterday when he suggested a minor incursion into Ukraine wouldn't necessitate the same response as a full invasion. That pointed clarification, emblematic of where we are in this crisis at this hour. A stage of deterrence, of rhetoric boiled down to if you do this, then we will do that. While wartime preparations go on behind the scenes, Russian troops on the border with Ukraine now number some 100,000. And as of this week, there's reportedly a Russian military presence in neighboring Belarus as well. Amid all that escalation, the Biden administration today made two moves. First, the State Department authorized certain NATO allies to rush anti-armor missiles and other U.S. weapons to Ukraine. Second, the U.S. imposed sanctions not on Russia this time, but on four Ukrainian government officials, two of them active members of Ukraine's parliament, in connection with an effort by Russia's intelligence service to destabilize the country from within. All that ahead of a high-stakes meeting tomorrow between Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. Let's bring into our coverage NBC News Chief Foreign Correspondent Richard Engel, live for us in Kiev, Ukraine. Also, MSNBC National Security Analyst Frank Figluzzi, former Assistant Director for Counterintelligence at the FBI, host of the Bureau podcast, and former Deputy National Security Advisor to President Obama, as well as an MSNBC contributor, Ben Rhodes. Three people who know a lot more than me. Let's get right to all of you. Richard Engel, what is the sense, what is the understanding and expectation on the ground?
So there's confusion among the Ukrainian people. They don't exactly understand why President Biden, who's been in government for so long, would reveal so many cards. A lot of people here were taken aback. Why would he appear to give a green light to Vladimir Putin to launch a limited military invasion? And that's the way they saw that. They saw his comments, which were quickly clarified by the White House last night and then clarified by President Biden himself in that clip you just played. The Ukrainian government is not just confused, they're annoyed. The Ukrainian government is trying not to talk about this crisis, and that's one of the things you notice when you're here in Kiev. The world media is talking about this, but if you turn on Ukrainian television, it's not really being discussed very much. And President Zelensky barely talks about the Russian troops on the border, and it is leading to some uneasiness here. People are wondering, is this crisis made up? Are the Western media exaggerating the threat because their own government isn't focusing on it? But yesterday, right before President Biden spoke, Zelensky did make some relatively rare comments, and he had just told the people here to be calm, that the risk of an invasion is not particularly high, that they should go living their lives as usual. And then just a short while afterwards, we saw those comments from President Biden saying that he expects that there will be some move by Russia, and that if it's a limited move, he implied that it could meet a somewhat limited response. So President Zelensky was aggravated and issued a sharp tweet that you may have heard about. It said, this is from Zelensky in English, "We want to remind the great powers that there are no minor incursions and small nations, just as there are no minor casualties and little grief from the loss of loved ones. I say this as the president of a great power."
So, Frank, what is the truth? I mean, there is a sense among American current and former national security officials that Russia very well may be the aggressor here. As Richard Engel's saying, that's sort of not being spoken about much to keep the country calm, it would appear. What is the reality?
Some of the current and former intelligence community folks I'm speaking with do think that there's almost an inevitability to some form of invasion. I'm not going to use the word incursion because I agree. There's no such thing as an incursion. It's an invasion.
It's an attack.
If Canada were to take over the New England states, I don't think we would call that a minor incursion. So I think sometimes it's a challenge, even for folks in the intelligence community, when they're speaking publicly, to distinguish and keep clear what they know from classified intelligence sources and what they're allowed to speak publicly. And we might have had a glimpse here of some intelligence kind of coming through in the transparency of President Biden when he said, you know, I think they are going to do something. I don't think he's working on a hunch or a gut feeling. I think there's some intelligence that likely supports that. And I think Putin's looking at that. And Richard's told us how Ukraine is confused. I think Putin's a little confused right now about what's going to happen, whether NATO will be divided if he does something small, large, or medium sized. But I think we need to prepare militarily and in the intelligence community for what some folks call prepping the battlefield. That would be yet another sign that things are happening. And today, what does prepping the battlefield mean? We could start seeing, at least in Ukraine, some pretty significant denials of service. We're already seeing reports of, you know, cyber attack, the energy sector. That could keep extending, even perhaps to us, if it's determined or Putin thinks we're likely to come in some form of military engagement or otherwise.
Ben Rhodes, to be fair, the president and the White House clarified this language that Zelensky's responding to almost immediately. But pick up on Frank's hypothesis that perhaps this was sort of President Biden alluding to what he knows is likely. And maybe, if there was some strategy there from your perspective.
Well, I think there are two issues at stake here. One is the reference to potential incursion. And the other was a suggestion that he had that there were divisions in NATO about the severity of sanctions. And that's very important to the Ukrainians because sanctions are really the most powerful deterrent that we have right now. And I think it's pretty clear when you have 100,000 troops essentially encircling this country, you have Russian disinformation campaigns, cyber attacks. Putin seems to be foreshadowing that he's going to do something. Now, I think the challenge and what Biden was speaking to yesterday is there's a range of things that could happen. You could see Russia move some more troops into the parts of eastern Ukraine where they've already been active and try to annex those regions. You could see Russia invade Ukraine a large scale, and we have a land war in Europe like we haven't seen in decades. And I'm sure that part of what's happening behind the scenes is the Europeans who we need for those sanctions are possibly divided on how far they will go if Putin does engage in a more limited invasion. Ultimately, remember that for these sanctions to work, Europe has to be involved. They do much more trade with Russia, particularly in the energy sector, and Europeans will take a much bigger hit to their economy. I think the bottom line that you see in these clarifications is it's the role of the United States to draw the most maximalist defense of Ukrainian sovereignty and of the right of a country to be a democracy, which is really what's at stake here. And it's the role of the United States to ensure the most maximalist response from the West, including preparing those sanctions. And so to have any hope of deterring Putin and informing his calculus, you need to make clear that anything he does is going to have the strongest possible response. And I think we saw that in the clarifications today.
Richard Engel, was there any reaction official or that you detected from your sources to the United States sanctions against the Ukrainian lawmakers and the sort of signal that Ukraine had a ways to go in clearing out corruption in their own government?
No, a lot of the attention here is focused on much more domestic politics. The former president Poroshenko has returned, and he's trying to present a challenge to President Zelensky. So the issues of national security are conspicuously absent from the public discourse here. Zelensky does not want to show that he potentially has Russian spies in his government, or that his government is potentially compromised in some way. He was telling people to go out and live their lives. He said that the risk of an incursion or the risk of an invasion now is no different than it was a year ago. And that doesn't seem to be the case by just looking at what's going on in the border area. So the message that he's giving to the Ukrainian people is very different from the discussion we're having right now.
So interesting. We'll continue to call on you. NBC's Richard Engel, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight. Ben and Frank are sticking around. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. We're back with Frank Figlizzi and Ben Rhodes. You know, Frank, Richard Engel's reporting on the domestic politics in Ukraine, and their domestic politics here for reasons I don't totally understand. Tucker Carlson backs Russia and compares Ukraine joining NATO with China controlling Mexico. Tucker Carlson said this, quote, imagine if Mexico fell under the direct military control of China. We would see that as a threat, of course. That's how Russia views NATO control of Ukraine. Why wouldn't they? We don't get anything out of pushing Ukraine into NATO. So why are we doing this? He added. It's as though the concept of democracies, of the very freedoms that allow him to say all the things he says, that allow all of us our freedoms of speech and association are just, I don't know, something he doesn't take into consideration. What is the danger of this sort of far-right extremist rhetoric backing Russia at a moment like this for our country?
Yeah, boy, I think we're both old enough to remember when far-right conservatives were champions of democracy and the right of free people to determine their own destiny, which is what we're all about right now with regard to Ukraine. And the false equivalency with China taking over Mexico is really got my attention, because it really is kind of a Russian talking point, and it's a very false equivalency. Look, yes, if China took control of Mexico, we'd push back hard, even militarily, right? And so would all of our allies. That's not what's going on here. It's the fact that Russia is talking about invading a free country that doesn't want to be invaded, and it's us that needs to push back there. That's what's happening. So where's the danger here? That someone like Tucker Carlson, who really controls seemingly the minds of many, many people, could actually influence them against a decision that the U.S. government is making in the national security interest. But even on a much larger scale, Nicole, we're talking about a segment of people here who actually would dismiss the idea that America is supposed to stand for liberty, freedom, and democracy around the world, and dismiss that idea in favor of an adversary having license to do what they want to do against a free people. We should have vehement disapproval, disagreements, discussions. Look at the Vietnam War era. That's a beautiful thing about America. We can disagree with our government's decision. But when we start siding with an adversary and we start spouting false equivalencies, that gets very dangerous.
Well, it's even more insidious than that. And I guess I'm old enough to have spent time on Fox News programs in my time as a Republican spokesperson, Ben, when they were offended by Vladimir Putin's Russia, when their identity was wrapped up in a patriotism that stood for democratic norms and this democracy. And I wonder if you can speak to, having written the book on how a country could slide into an autocracy, how does a corporation with as much reach and influence as Fox News fall in line behind Tucker Carlson when there are other hosts who've been there for many years who had very different views and ideologies on Vladimir Putin's Russia?
Well, another thing is Tucker Carlson recently said he's going to return to Hungary, where his favorite far-right autocrat Viktor Orban is prime minister. Orban, of course, has also been a key European supporter of Vladimir Putin. And look, I think a common strain, let's just be blunt about it, Nicole, a common strain among the politics of these different countries, the far right in this country, in Hungary, and Russia, is an embrace of a kind of white ethno-nationalist authoritarianism that has a similar set of opponents, immigrants, the LGBT movement, anything that challenges a traditional set of identity politics. And what is so chilling right now is that the fidelity to that brand of identity politics has become stronger in the far right in this country than fidelity to democracy and democratic values and what America stands for. And I think right now at this moment, one thing that President Biden needs to do is there's actually a very direct linkage to what he's trying to do in this country. And we saw in the fight for voting rights that reached a bit of a dead end yesterday, but isn't over yet, and what he's trying to defend around the world. We're trying to preserve and protect the survivability of democracy in this country and in other places around the world. And the forces that are challenging democracy in this country are in many cases the same kind of forces, the same brand of politics, the same brand of nationalism that is challenging democracy around the world. And I think we have to come together in defense of that democratic story, both in terms of our policies and in terms of the arguments that we're making, because we see that there's no reticence on behalf of Tucker Carlson or, frankly, some elements of the Republican Party now to embrace fundamentally undemocratic brands of politics.
It's unbelievable. Frank Figliuzzi, Ben Rhodes, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. When we come back, it is perhaps the biggest example of fraud in the 2020 election, those fake slates of electors who signed phony documents seeking to claim that the disgraced ex-president won states. He clearly lost, and bigly. Will those fraudsters be prosecuted criminally? And how high up did their potential crimes go? That story is next. Some new reporting in the Washington Post today digs deeper into an area we know is also of interest to the January 6th Select Committee investigation. That plot to overthrow our democracy using fake electors who attempted to change their respective states' electoral votes in 2020 from the rightful winner, President-elect Joe Biden, to the loser, Donald J. Trump. Post reports that it was Rudy Giuliani, no surprise, who mainly oversaw the electors internally within the campaign and worked to replace electors who were unwilling to go along with the plan. This new reporting comes as calls to prosecute fake electors are growing, a move that could reveal a potential conspiracy that just might go to the highest levels of the disgraced ex-president's inner circle. In a piece for The Bulwark, attorney Philip Rotner writes that this could be Trump's Watergate, writing this, quote, if state and federal law enforcement authorities convene grand juries to investigate the low-level GOP officials who signed and submitted phony electoral certificates in the 2020 election, the entire conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election could unravel. Joining our conversation is Tim Miller, former RNC spokesman, now writer-at-large for The Bulwark and an MSNBC contributor. Harry's still here. I always hoped that the 1-6 committee was going from the top down and the bottom up because these electors put their names to fraudulent documents in states that President Joe Biden won by huge margins that were not the subject of any criminal investigations by Bill Barr or flagged by lifelong Republican Chris Krebs. What is your sense of where that stands as a sort of state investigation in these seven states, Tim?
Well, as far as where the investigation stands, I think that's a question for Garland, which Rotner gets into in the article in The Bulwark today. And hopefully this is an opportunity for the attorney general to be aggressive and potentially identify people that have committed falsified documents in hopes of uncovering, who it was that organized this effort. And look, there, if you are a regular voter who fills out a, absentee ballot request fraudulently, that's a crime, and it should be. By the way, we've noticed a lot of the Trump voters, turns out, did that over the course of the last 4 years, despite them saying it was the left committing voter fraud. And so how is this any different? If you are fraudulently advancing a vote versus fraudulently advancing your role as an elector to the Electoral College. So I think it's potentially something for the Department of Justice to look into. The most interesting thing here, I think the Washington Post report saying that Rudy, was organizing this, which shouldn't be a surprise. Kayleigh McEnany, who was the White House press secretary at the time, was talking about these alternate slates of electors on Fox a few days before the documents were put forth. So I think that's another indication, if Kayleigh and Rudy were both familiar with this, that it was something that was happening in the inner circle of the White House.
Well, and Harry, we know that Kayleigh has cooperated, at least in part, with the 1-6 committee. And we know that the committee is looking at this effort. It's in some of the cover letters and some of the subpoenas for campaign staff to probe those contacts in the states and the statewide efforts. We also know that John Eastman put it all on paper. And so to some extent, they were pursuing a 7-state strategy that lawyer John Eastman put on paper. What is your sense of, you know, the Michigan's attorney general has been on the show and on my colleague Rachel Maddow's show saying she turned all this evidence that she has, which is largely these documents that were returned to the state of Michigan from the National Archives, to the feds. What is your sense of whether that is enough to commence scrutiny if that isn't already happening?
Commence scrutiny, 100% enough. And here's another little fact. All five, there are seven, but two of them kind of hedged their bet. All five use the same words, the same font, the same everything. So there's obviously a higher coordination here. And there's independent reason to think Mark Meadows is neck deep in it as well. Is there enough for an investigation? Surely. I mean, it's almost hard to see what the defense here would be of these state electors other than, I mean, I just thought it was okay, but that wouldn't be a defense to a criminal allegation. And by my count, I just gave it a little try in the last hour. I'm up to about five federal crimes that could easily have been broken. This is pretty vivid stuff and damn near smoking gun material, as both Bill Kristol and George Conway have said.
And Tim, sometimes the Watergate comparisons fall short. This to the plumbers is a pretty apt one.
Well, I think it's apt in the sense that this is clearly a plot that was happening from inside the Oval Office, right? You know, the crimes are different, of course. But if this is something that Meadows is neck deep in, to Harry's point, this is something that, you know, Trump himself, Trump's lawyer that we're working on, I think it's very clearly evidence that, additional evidence. We already have some evidence that the White House was constructing, you know, a multi-pronged, multifaceted effort in order to overturn the results of the election, including doing things that were outside the law. And, Amanda Carpenter is another article in the Bulwark while you're over there today, listing out the six different elements of this strategy. Because as we've talked about, Nicole, I think sometimes people, you know, it's easy to look at Rudy and he's so ridiculous and be like, you know, is this coup really serious? But if you combine the fraudulent electors with the pressure on state legislatures, with the pressure on secretaries of state, with what is happening in the House of Representatives to overturn the election and the other items that Amanda lists, put it all together, it's still a plan that wasn't likely to work and kind of a dumb plan, but it was a premeditated plan coming from the very top to overturn a free and fair election.
Tim Miller, Harry Lipman, thank you for spending some time.
With one more thing to add, the Eastman memo is where it begins.
And it's on paper. Thank you both for spending some time with us. Quick break for us. We'll be right back.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
A quick update on a story we brought you earlier in the week. NPR reported that Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch refused to wear a mask during oral arguments, forcing Justice Sonia Sotomayor to work remotely because she has diabetes. NPR's story included that Chief Justice John Roberts asked all of them to wear masks. Yesterday, Justices Sotomayor and Gorsuch put out a rare joint statement denying any mask tension, saying, quote, "While we may sometimes disagree about the law, we are warm colleagues and friends." It was followed by a statement from Chief Justice Roberts, who also denied asking any of the justices to wear a mask. Moments ago, NPR acknowledged a misleading choice of words, but stood by its reporting, writing this, quote, "The NPR report said the Chief Justice's ask to the justices had come in some form." Quick break for us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We are grateful.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.